know, they're based on a citizens' initiative. The idea was to reduce the influence of big money in politics.
A trial gets underway in Anchorage over limits to campaign contributions. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, April 25th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, lawmakers start a second week past the 90-day session.
In my mind, as long as we're making progress, let's just keep working.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Support for Alaska Public Media's Energy News Desk comes from Bettisworth North, Architects and Planners, and the Atwood Foundation.
Money is the lifeblood of a political campaign, and if a legal challenge to Alaska's campaign contribution limits succeeds, there could be more of it. APRN's Liz Ruskin attended the first day of a trial in U.S. District Court in Anchorage today. Liz, who initiated this lawsuit?
The lawsuit was filed by a couple of Republican donors and District 18 of the state Republican Party. And three named plaintiffs were witnesses this morning. All of them said they wanted to give more to particular campaigns or groups, but they couldn't because of the campaign finance caps.
What are the limits that they're challenging?
They're challenging several of the limits, including the biggest, the one you hear most about is probably the $500 maximum contribution that anyone can make to a candidate, any individual, to a candidate like for the legislature. Also, they're challenging the aggregate limit on out-of-state contributions a campaign can accept. One of the witnesses today and one of the plaintiffs is Representative Wes Keller's brother-in-law, who couldn't give to his brother-in-law because Representative Keller had already reached his $3,000 limit on accepting out-of-state contributions. So the relative couldn't give because he lives in Wisconsin.
When were these campaign limits brought into being?
We've had these limits since the 1990s. Former Representative David Finkelstein was a big champion of them. And he is back in town now. He expects to be called as a witness in the case later in the week. And here's what he had to say about them.
The provision's been in place for almost 20 years, and they've worked well. They're based on a citizens' initiative. The idea was to reduce the influence of big money in politics, and it's worked well.
So do the plaintiffs want to abolish contribution limits altogether?
No. Kevin Clarkson, the plaintiff's attorney, says if the lawsuit is successful, the judge would throw out the current limits and the legislature would later come back and impose new ones. Clarkson thinks a $1,000 cap is more appropriate. He says the lower cap hurts regular folks who want to run for office and challengers because incumbents never seem to have trouble raising money. I talked to him outside the courthouse today.
People who can give $1,000, it's probably less than 1% that do that, and they're people with means. But here's where the money really comes in. When you set the limit at $500, what that does is it advantages the independently wealthy candidates who can come and put $1 million into a campaign, and then you have challengers or whoever's running against them, maybe it's an incumbent, trying to raise money within that $500 limit range. That's a disparity.
So, Liz, who's defending the current law?
Well, the state, the AG's office, Assistant Attorney General Laura Fox, on cross-examinations today, she seemed to be bringing out that donors have other ways of giving to campaigns, like going door-to-door, consulting, waving signs. So that was one of her main points today.
Is it a jury trial, and how long is it supposed to last?
No, it's not a jury trial. Judge Timothy Burgess will decide it, U.S. District Court judge, and it's expected to go on at least a week.
All right, Liz, thanks for that update.
Thank you.
The legislature didn't take any actions today as it began the second week after the scheduled end of the session. But Senate President Kevin Meyer says he'd like to see the legislature complete its work soon.
In my mind, as long as we're making progress, let's just keep working.
The biggest stumbling block for completing the session is finding agreement on changes to oil and gas taxes. Legislators also are considering major reforms to the state's criminal justice and sentencing system. Lawmakers must finish work on the state budget, and they're weighing whether to draw money from permanent fund earnings to help pay for it. This could lead to a cut in the size of permanent fund dividends. Meyer says the Senate will be ready to act on the budget and permanent fund bills once the House finishes its work on oil and gas tax credits. It's not clear how long the legislature will remain in Juneau. Construction work has begun on the Capitol building. The session was scheduled to end on April 17th, but under the Constitution, the regular session can go until May 18th. A special session would be held on the road system, could be held on the road system, but Meyer would like to see the legislature finish in Juneau.
Progress isn't going as quickly as we'd hoped in the House. And it's as I mentioned, it's my desire, and I think most of us in the Senate, is that since we're in regular session, sessions are held in Juneau.
Meyer and other legislators and staff members plan to visit different sites around Juneau to see if they could host the legislature during construction. The construction is scheduled to intensify next week. The House Finance Committee is planning to consider amendments to the criminal justice and sentencing bill tomorrow. Two people are dead after a crash over the weekend on the Seward Highway north of Girdwood. Alaska State Troopers responded to the collision just after 7 p.m. on Saturday. Troopers say a Subaru Forester was driving north on the highway when it crossed into the southbound lanes, hitting a van, then an SUV towing a boat. Both occupants of the Subaru were pronounced dead at the scene. The deceased are identified as Jackson Moore, age 36, and Charisse James, age 25, both of Kisilov. The passenger in the Jeep sustained injuries and was transported to Alaska Native Medical Center in Anchorage. Troopers say all occupants of the vehicles involved were wearing seatbelts. The investigation is ongoing. A Two Rivers man also died in a weekend crash of an all-terrain vehicle. Troopers say 55-year-old Daniel Begas died early Saturday morning. Troopers say Begas had been driving south on Grange Hall Road when his four-wheeler rolled several times. He was not wearing a helmet. Emergency responders say he was dead at the scene. Troopers say alcohol was a factor in the crash. An autopsy has been ordered. Two Rivers is an unincorporated community east of Fairbanks along miles 13 to 25 Chena Hot Springs Road. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Dillingham wins big at the Native Youth Olympics.
I was really nervous and yeah, I just had my hopes up and came in really confident.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence,
and by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
The statewide Native Youth Olympics tournament wrapped up on Saturday after 3 days of competition. Dillingham earned the rare distinction of winning both first place overall and the top sportsmanship award. KDLG's Hannah Colton reports.
NYO fans are both cheering and wincing as they watch the final event of the weekend. It's the seal hop, and that squeaking noise is the boys' knuckles skidding on the floor as they hop in plank position.
Oh my God.
Each athlete mimics a hunter's movement with his fingers curled around a spear as he sneaks up on a seal. Minutes before was the girls' seal hop. The female athletes hop on palms instead of knuckles, and the endurance event was the Dillingham Wolverines' final win of the weekend.
Hi, my name is Brittany Dre. I am a sophomore at Dillingham High School, and I went 127, at least 127 feet, and I won first. This is my second time winning state for seal hop.
Dre hopped 9 inches farther than last year, setting a new personal best. Dre and her other teammates who medaled helped earn their team a total of 41 points. Justin Dye placed first in the wrist carry.
I came in pretty confident, so I did think I was going, but I was really nervous. And yeah, I just had my hopes up and came in really confident.
Dye was carried 644 and a half feet by Martin Gardner and Gabe Gomez. Those two also carried 8th grader Sadie Tuckwood to a first place victory in the girls' wrist carry. Junior Jacinto George is a first timer to NYO. He won first in Indian stick pull. On top of the team's impressive athletic performance, Dillingham was also chosen for the 3rd year in a row for the coveted Team Sportsmanship Award. It's a distinction voted on by other coaches and officials in the competition, and it singles out a team for their kindness, work ethic, and willingness to help out. Dillingham head coach Carl Clark says it's been 15 years since Dillingham won the top spot, and being picked for sportsmanship on top of that is a special triumph.
For Dillingham, it's never been done. So, a lot of personal bests. That's what we shot for this week, and you can see when we shoot for personal bests what happens. So, super, super proud today.
Another impressive performance from the Bristol Bay region came from Remus Bavila, a senior from Togiak, who took second place in the Alaskan high kick. In second place overall was the team from Lower Kuskokwim School District. Unalaska took 3rd in the overall competition, followed by Matsu A-team in 4th and the Anchorage A-team in 5th. Reporting in Dillingham, I'm Hannah Colton.
The Bristol Bay Native Corporation will soon expand its footprint in Southwest Alaska's tourism industry. Last week, BBNC announced plans to buy Katmai Land Incorporated, which runs an airline and 3 lodges around the Katmai National Park. KDLG's Dave Benninger has more.
Katmai Land is a major sport fishing and bear viewing lodge operation built and founded by Ray Peterson in 1950, which predates Katmai National Park by 30 years. Today, it is the largest operator within the park, taking tourists from around the world to iconic Brooks Falls and other destinations. Sonny Peterson is Ray's son and is now the owner and president of Katmai Land.
You know, I've been working out there pretty much my whole life, and but I'm getting to be older, and I'm going to be 64 this year and looking towards retirement eventually. And, you know, BBNC is a local company. It's owned by people who live out in Bristol Bay, and I think it's a good fit. I'm proud to be selling it to them.
Peterson says Katmai Land probably runs 5,000 to 6,000 people a year through the national park, and 1,000 or so more through its 2 sport fishing lodges. He says business has been good, and he doesn't expect new owner BBNC to change much.
That's their plan. I'm going to still manage it for at least 2 years, perhaps longer. And they're keeping all the staff and managers at our lodges and at Katmai Air. And they basically feel like they're buying a going concern, and they don't want to mess it up. But if anything, they'll be able to maybe help us improve it.
That's a sentiment echoed by BBNC President and CEO Jason Matrokin.
Our track record is to look at and target businesses that are success stories. We're not necessarily in the business of buying fixer-uppers, if you will.
4 years ago, BBNC bought the Mission Lodge on Lake Aleknagik, its first major investment in Bristol Bay since selling Peter Pan Seafoods back in 1979. Last year, the corporation purchased Bristol Alliance Fuels in Dillingham. Katmai Land, Inc. is the 3rd of its recent acquisitions in the region. Besides hopefully turning a profit for shareholders, Matrokin says there are the non-financial components of these investments to consider.
This is an opportunity for added diversification, not just within BBNC's investment mix, but within the region itself. There are employment opportunities, training opportunities, and particularly in the case of Katmai Land, this is a direct tie for BBNC with our culture, our lands, and to expand our relationship with the Park Service.
Of course, the multi-million dollar question will go unanswered for now. Neither side was willing to disclose terms of the sale, but considering Katmai Land's many assets, it no doubt carried a hefty price tag. The sale won't be finalized until the end of May. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
A disease that's killed 7 million bats on the East Coast was recently found in Washington State. Experts fear it's only a matter of time before it reaches Alaska. Very little is known about bats in the state. To help learn more about bats in Southeast region, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game has started a program that asks the public to help survey the flying mammals.
White-nosed bat syndrome keeps bats from hibernating properly. It's a fungus that irritates them and wakes them up too early. And since it's cold out, the bats can't find insects they need to survive, so they starve.
So it's really, really serious. It may cause a couple of extinctions of our North American bats.
That's Steve Lewis with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Lewis and other bat experts don't know how the disease could affect bats in Southeast because very little is known about bats in the region. People have long known they exist because they can be seen at night. But only in recent years have scientists identified 7 species of bats in Southeast. 2 larger-sized bats, the silver-haired bat and hoary bat. The latter weighs between 20 and 35 grams, which is about the size of a mouse. And then there's 5 kinds of little bats known as myotis. They are really tiny. As Lewis likes to say,
you could put 3 of them in an envelope, put on 1 stamp and no overweight.
They weigh just 5 to 7 grams each. But the ravenous little guys love their insects. Just 1 bat can eat 1,000 insects in an hour. They prefer moths, but also go after mosquitoes. The 5 little bats look so similar that you can't tell them apart just by looking at them. You have to test their DNA or turn to the tricky business of their calls.
They're all ultrasonic, so they're all above what we can hear. But some of them are in the 30 kilohertz range, some of them are in the 40 kilohertz range, and then they have different patterns, so the sweeps when you look at a sonogram are all different.
There is acoustic equipment that can pick up bat calls and translate them into something human ears can hear. Lewis has been traveling around Southeast training the public on the equipment as part of a citizen bat monitoring program. The program relies heavily on the public to do the surveys. 6 Petersburg residents have signed up to participate. This is their part. They drive a specific route 45 minutes after sunset. There is a microphone attached to the roof of the car by a magnet. A cable connects it to a bat detector in the car. There's also a GPS on the dashboard. You need 2 people, one to drive right around 20 miles per hour, and the other to watch the equipment. In Petersburg, the route makes a loop on Mitkoff Island and takes about 1.5 hours to complete. Lewis says you will know when you've heard some bats.
Because you'll have your bat detector turned up with the volume, and so you'll go along and you'll hear, and that'll be a bat.
Here is an actual recording. The longer part, when the sound changes, is the bat eating an insect. But it actually happens a lot faster. What we hear has been slowed down 8 times.
So that was an 1/8 of how long it takes to catch the bug, eat it, and keep going. So that's how they get 1,000 bugs in an hour.
Between the data stored on the bat detector and the GPS, scientists will know what bats were heard where. All of the digital data will be stored on a memory card and later emailed to Juno. Scientists want to find out where the bats are hanging out. They are guessing that it's a bit different than larger bat caves down south.
We're getting a feel that they hibernate less in caves and more in cracks in the ground, talus slopes and things, which makes us hope that white-nose syndrome won't be quite as serious up here because there's not hundreds of thousands of bats all aggregated into a cave hibernating together. So it may not spread as fast anyway, but we really don't know at this point.
They do know that at night, the bats are foraging in open places like over muskegs and water. In the daytime, they like roosting in old-growth trees, especially mothers with their pups who prefer being under the tree's peeling bark on the south side where it's warmer. In general, Lewis says bats have a bad reputation for being scary, which is undeserved. He says while you don't want to handle them because they could carry rabies, they aren't a scary creature of the night, nor are they a kind of flying mouse, as they've often been called.
They're not flying mice at all. They're very small, but they're long-lived. So our bats here, the little brown bat, lives for anywhere from 20 to 35 years. And they have 1 pup a year if they've managed to raise it. So when they get knocked down by something like white nose, it's going to take a really long time for our bat populations to rebound.
The Citizen Bat Monitoring Program will run April through September in Southeast. The goal is to get a survey done every 2 weeks during that time. In Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
Chilista Corporation is campaigning to reduce quorum requirements at its annual shareholder meetings to prevent invalidating future meeting votes and wasting corporation money when quorum isn't met. Current quorum needs more than 50% majority. Chilista wants to reduce that to one-third or about 33%, and the corporation wants it to happen before descendants enroll as shareholders next year. The corporation wants to make the change during the annual shareholders meeting in July. Tom Leonard, Chilista Communications Manager, says quorum for annual shareholder meetings average barely over the needed 50% majority. Leonard says the corporation fears that average could plummet with descendants enrolling next year when shareholder numbers go from 13,000 to around 40,000. That's because the corporation expects younger voters will reduce the likelihood of reaching quorum in the future based on voting trends among young Alaska voters. According to the Division of Elections, in 2014, less than 41% of 18 to 34-year-old registered voters cast ballots in the Alaska general election. Lower voter turnout would mean wasted time and money for Chilista and its shareholders. When quorum isn't met, votes are invalid, and Chilista spends about $100,000 rescheduling its annual gathering. The corporation hopes reducing its quorum requirement will buffer these potential losses.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
Alaska Public Media is seeking donations for our 2016 Big Alaska Statewide TV Travel Auction to be held on May 19th and 20th. We're looking for trips, accommodations, activities, and adventures. Your generous donation will help us in our commitment to growth and excellence in programming on Alaska Public Media. There's more information online on our events page on our website at alaskapublic.org.
A pilot avoided injury in Wasilla over the weekend after a mechanical mishap. Alaska wildlife troopers were notified of an aircraft accident just before 3 p.m. on Saturday at an airstrip near the intersection of Johnson Road and Schultz Road in Wasilla. The pilot, James Riggs, reportedly lost power just as his plane lifted off. He says the plane settled back onto the ground before rolling off the end of the runway into heavy brush and debris. Riggs was uninjured, but the aircraft did sustain damage. Going beyond known risk factors for breast cancer has led to research that looks at the ecology of risk. Dr. Ted Shetler is the science director of the Science and Environmental Health Network. He is also the author of The Ecology of Breast Cancer, The Promise of Prevention and the Hope for Healing. Dr. Shetler says considering all the conditions that cancer arises from means not just individual risks such as genetics, but community, ecosystem, and societal concerns.
What happens in utero, in infancy, and in childhood influences breast cancer risk decades later. So I thought that those observations, which are clearly derived from an analysis of what's published in scientific journals, lent itself to an ecological analysis. So that's why I called it the ecology of breast cancer.
Risk factors even in utero. Talk about what some of those are.
Women who took diethylstilbestrol, a synthetic estrogen, while they were pregnant, back in the 90s and 50s and 60s, actually created an increased risk for a variety of adverse health outcomes in their daughters years later. And what we've learned in recent years is that women who were exposed to DES in utero are at about a twofold increased risk of breast cancer after the age of 40. Another entirely different set of studies has been published by Barbara Cohn and her colleagues in the Bay Area of California. They had access to blood specimens that had been collected and then stored and frozen over a number of years. in which they could measure DDT levels. She was able to show that higher levels of exposure to DDT in the womb resulted in a fivefold increased risk of breast cancer in women in adulthood after the age of 40 or 50.
What should women who are young women and older that are in control of their own health and taking care of themselves, what should they be focused on doing and not doing to help protect themselves from breast cancer?
In general, what we've learned is a diet that emphasizes fruits and vegetables, and in particular, darkly, deeply colored vegetables are very nutritious and have a lot of cancer-protective properties. We can talk about whole soy as being protective, interestingly enough. And I emphasize whole soy because I'm not talking about soy supplements. They can have a different effect than an adverse effect, whereas whole soy is protective. Using nuts is beneficial. Healthy fats rather than unhealthy fats. And then I would finally mention the importance of vitamin D. Vitamin D is really not a vitamin. It's a hormone. The precursors are in the skin, and sunlight hits the skin and converts the precursors after a couple of passes through the liver and the kidneys, into active hormone, which interacts with hormone receptors, vitamin D receptors, in many tissues of the body, including the breast. And with regard to breast cancer, it helps the cells maintain the right level of cellular differentiation and proliferation, so we don't get too many of them too fast. It helps maintain normal hormone levels. Many epidemiologic studies, not all, but many of them show that low levels of vitamin D increase the risk of breast cancer. And interestingly, the American Academy of Pediatrics right now recommends that all babies, whether they're formula-fed or breastfed, should be vitamin D supplemented. All babies.
Dr. Ted Shetler is the author of The Ecology of Breast Cancer. He is speaking in Anchorage tonight, Fairbanks tomorrow, and in Nome on Thursday. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin and Josh Edge in Anchorage, Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Hannah Colton and Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Angela Denning in Petersburg, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, and Quentin Chandler in Homer. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska's tobacco quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins lead to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The Alaska Public Radio Network, in cooperation with our member stations, provides the most complete, timely, and accessible source of Alaska news, current affairs, and cultural information.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.